There are political revolutions and there are social revolutions. Sometimes they're combined, as in the case of the Russian Revolution, which both overthrew the Tsar and attempted to transform the economic system and class relations. And sometimes, historically, you get just one kind or the other. What gets called the American Revolution, for instance, was primarily political. There were activists within it who fought for larger change, for redistributing the wealth, for instance, even for racial, if not gender, equality. But the outcome was a political revolution, independence from Great Britain, and not much of a social revolution. The U.S. effort at fundamental social transformation came later, 90 or so years after the political revolution. Unfortunately for us, it was defeated. I'm talking about the period of a few years during and after the Civil War that we call Reconstruction, arguably the key turning point in U.S. history, which is why, 150 years later, that period, Reconstruction, has become a flashpoint now in the cultural wars of our own times. So how do events of that long ago become grist for right-wing media hosts and think tanks, for denunciations in state legislatures and mean-spirited talking points for governors running for higher office? They take on that prominence if, one, the same issues of racial equality, democratic control, and working-class organization remain unresolved, and two, those issues are being raised with effectiveness by activist groups. Today, as we celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., it's in the context of what might have been if the Reconstruction struggle had won, and what of its legacy should still encourage our own struggles. What then was Reconstruction? And in the current debates over its meaning, what is it important for us to get across? Reconstruction, then, is our case study in today's episode of Another World is Possible. That was our theme music, We Have the Guillotine, performed by The Coup. Let me start with a personal anecdote that connects Martin Luther King Jr. with the opposition we sometimes encounter in schools against the teaching of racial justice. Sometime in the early 1990s, I was in Atlanta and stopped to see Coretta Scott King, Martin's widow, whom I knew from having taught at an institution where she served on the board. Hearing a bit about my family, she gave me a large framed portrait of Martin as a gift for my son's elementary school here in Portland. Given the extent to which MLK's image had already been tamed and co-opted, his revolutionary intentions distorted into a bland homily about nonviolence, I thought the school would welcome the gift. Instead, I was given to understand that the portrait of a black man who organized for social and economic change might be offensive to some of the parents. This was not quite stated explicitly, only that the school preferred to avoid controversy. The portrait was stuck away in a closet in the principal's office and never hung. That controversy, on the vastly greater national scale, has come out of the closet. Thanks to Black Lives Matter and the uprising about policing black communities, a range of issues connected to race are now part of widespread public contentiousness. Among those issues have been debates over school curricula. We are now riven by widespread attempts to shout down school boards or take them over, to ban books and gag teachers, and efforts by governors and state legislatures to meddle with the specifics of classroom content. Last week's debacle in the U.S. Congress had Representative McCarthy denouncing what he called woke indoctrination as part of his campaign to become Speaker of the House. These reactionary attacks have an additional subtext. They're part of the larger effort to do away with public education entirely. Some of the reaction against Black Lives Matter first took the form of an attack on critical race theory, originally an academic approach in law schools to investigate how institutions in our society perpetuate racial disparity, now turned into a right-wing catch-all phrase for any teaching about the existence and consequences of racism. More recently, part of that controversy has focused on how we understand the history, the defeated opportunity, the inspiration of Reconstruction, the history of an attempted revolution, the history that's been suppressed. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a magisterial book on Reconstruction way back in the 1930s. Much of what I know about the era comes from his book, Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. But the history he uncovered was not what the powers that be wanted told. Here's Du Bois recounting just one instance of the censorship he encountered.
The editors of the 14th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica asked me for an article on the history of the American Negro. From my manuscript, they cut out all my references to Reconstruction. I insisted on including the following statement. White historians have ascribed the faults and failures of Reconstruction to Negro ignorance and corruption. But the Negro insists that it was Negro loyalty and the Negro vote alone that restored the South to the Union, established the new democracy both for white and black, and instituted public schools. The editor refused to print it. I was not satisfied and refused to allow the article to appear.
Thank you, Patricia. Reading from Du Bois. Reconstruction wasn't taught in schools or was barely taught until recently. If mentioned at all in an American history class, it was done dismissively as a sort of victim blaming. Freed slaves, the common teaching went, were given the vote but proved incompetent in its exercise. But that's a history both minimized and distorted. Think of the sentence I just said, freed slaves, as if freedom was something granted, as distinct from black working people playing a major role in freeing themselves, as if freedom is simply a legal status and people could be free in the harsh economic circumstances that resulted with few resources. Given the vote, again presenting black working people as passive recipients of the action and generosity of others. Proved incompetent in exercising the vote. Well, that's simply a convenient, self-serving lie. But classroom practice is changing. Thanks to the outstanding efforts of the Zinn Education Project, the journal Rethinking Schools, and the organization Teaching for Change, thousands of teachers across the country have publicly pledged they'll not be intimidated. For many, teaching a fuller, more accurate version of Reconstruction is a way to equip students to understand and respond to the issues of our own times. It's a way also to show that historical outcomes aren't inevitable, that history could have turned out differently, and that what happens now and in the future is at least partly dependent on our own efforts. That's where I'd start, where I'm teaching now, or at least aim at as the basic understanding, that Reconstruction was a revolutionary period, ultimately an opportunity lost, a key epoch in determining the struggles of today. A basic reinterpretation of Reconstruction starts with recognizing the agency of the people who were enslaved, their own role in freeing themselves. Du Bois used the term general strike in characterizing the work stoppage of hundreds of thousands of slaves that cut off supplies to Confederate troops, that guided the Union armies, that left plantations and seaports and workshops to join the Union forces, even serving with distinction in the Union Army. The emancipation we celebrate on Juneteenth was not only a grant by President Lincoln, but Lincoln's response to the many, many former slaves who had already freed themselves. It was, among other reasons, a result of Lincoln's recognition that the Union needed black soldiers to win the war. Agency, that is, black people acting on their own behalf and on behalf of others, and not simply being the recipients of others' actions, is an even bigger part of the Reconstruction story. Leadership among the rebellious slaves came extensively from fugitives, slaves who had fled earlier, and from blacks who had not been slaves. Already during the war, blacks self-organized communities of former slaves, sometimes with the aid of the Union Army and government, sometimes having to force Union acceptance. These communities were rehearsals for the black leadership in southern states that followed the war. I mentioned President Lincoln. He's become a symbol around the world for the freedom struggle he partly facilitated, partly only tolerated. Taking a break in our discussion, here's an excerpt from a Pablo Neruda poem relating anti-imperialist struggles now to the 19th century struggle of U.S. slaves. It's an effort to remind those of us in the heart of imperialism of Lincoln's legacy. Let the rail splitter awake. Again, presented by Patricia.
If you arm your hordes, North America, to destroy that pure frontier and bring the butcher from Chicago to govern the music and the order that we love, we'll rise from the stones in the air to bite you. We'll rise from the last window to pour fire on you. We'll rise from the deepest waves to sting you with spines. We'll rise from the furrow so that the seed will pound you like a Colombian fist. We'll rise to deny you bread and water. We'll rise to burn you in hell. Let none of this come to pass. Let the rail splitter awake. Let Abe come, let his aged yeast raise the green and gold earth of Illinois. Let him lift up his axe in his own town against the new slaveholders, against the slave lash, against the poisoned printing press, against the bloodied merchandise they want to sell. Let them march, singing and smiling, the young white, the young Negro, against the walls of gold, against the manufacturer of hate, against the merchant of their blood. Let them sing, laugh, and conquer. Let the rail splitter awake.
The rail splitter, of course, was Abraham Lincoln. Equally important on the question of agency was the contribution of black people after the war. Far from a story of incompetence, a lie that's been created to justify not only Ku Klux Klan depredations and racist laws, but also the suppression of the revolutionary potential of Reconstruction. Blacks played prominent and progressive roles in governance, for instance, creating public school systems in the South, where there had been barely any, expanding the right to serve on juries and to vote, enhancing women's rights to own property, progressive taxation, making the state more responsive to social needs. All of these, incidentally, were benefits to poor whites as well as to blacks. This is why Du Bois called Reconstruction the finest effort to achieve democracy for the working class ever. And that's where some of the opposition came from. Enhanced services required taxing the remaining Southern wealthy to pay for them. Northern capital flooding into the South, wanted a continuing supply of cheap labor. Poor Southern whites had to choose whether their allegiances were to other workers or to wealthier whites. Class and race allegiances in extended opposition to each other. Clearly, there's a lot more to say about Reconstruction, about how it was defeated, about the role and weaknesses of the abolitionist movement, about the ambiguous response of the organized white worker movement, both North and South, and about 150 years worth of attempts to suppress the real history. I'll come back to that history in another episode of Another World is Possible. Meanwhile, a lot of creativity is going into the teaching. I'd like to introduce you to just a bit of it now and come back to more examples of powerful pedagogy around Reconstruction, also in that future episode. Imagine a classroom. It's well into the term. The students have already studied slavery and the Civil War. Through role plays and simulations and other practices, they've developed confidence that classmates and teachers listen to them respectfully, and that their own disagreements can illuminate the history they're studying. They're gaining the sense that looking at dilemmas and tough choices can be a better way to understand the past than memorizing a textbook's dates and interpretations. Now imagine that every student in the class is asked to take on the perspective of a former slave at the conclusion of the Civil War. Imagine that you're one of those students. You get to decide some aspects of your role. For instance, you may or may not have heard the demand for 40 acres and a mule, for the resources to get a new start. Is that a new start for you alone, or do you have a family? Perhaps you're searching for family members who were sold away. Now that you're set in your role, the teacher poses questions for you to think about and discuss. If you were given the right to the land you had spent your life working, would you be willing, in exchange for that land, to promise that you'd continue growing cotton for Northern capital? What safeguards should there be for you before the Confederate States are readmitted to the Union? Should people who were disloyal to the United States be allowed to vote? Should women? Notice that these are not right or wrong questions. Rather, they're entry points to the heart of the history. After hashing them out in class, as if you were part of a convention of the newly freed, you step out of your role, and the teacher introduces the class to the primary sources. You may be surprised at how the history differs from your expectations, and that surprise may raise yet further questions for you. Having already explored some of the difficult decisions that constitute the history, you and your classmates are much better equipped to understand what actually happened in that era. Perhaps you are better equipped as well to appreciate the tough choices and responsibilities in our own times. This has been Norm Diamond, Another World is Possible, for the Old Mole Variety Hour.